roll, baby, on MMA Junkie Radio with Gorgeous George and Goz. This is what we do and why we do it, baby. We rollin'!
Covering MMA from all over the world, this is the premier stop for all your combat sports needs. MMA Junkie Radio from the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino in the fight capital of the world, Las Vegas, Nevada. The lights are on and the mics are hot. It's time to get your MMA fix, junkies. Take it away, Big John.
Gorgeous George and Goz, are you ready? Junkie Nation, are you ready? Well, let's get it on.
What is up, Junkie Nation? It is Thursday, October 22nd. It is fight week, and we got a great show planned for you today. Of course, we're going to go over everything. Pertaining to UFC 254, which takes place on Saturday. Don't forget, Goz and I are hosting a watch-along. Watch the fights along with us, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. That's right. It's an early edition of the UFC pay-per-view because they're going live out there in Abu Dhabi, primarily to appease the Russian crowd, as Khabib Nurmagomedov is going to be trying to unify the titles. He's the undisputed champion. He'll be taking on the interim champion, Justin Gaethje. We're going to go over a lot of news nuggets as well, and we got a superstar who's going to start the show off with us. It's Corey Sandhagen, who's coming off a huge win over Marlon Moraes a couple weeks ago. So buckle up, Junkie Nation. Here we go.
Habla español, amigo.
Hola amigos, Danny Segura dropping in. Just wanted to let you know about MMA Junkie's latest podcast. It's Hablemos MMA, a weekly Spanish language show dedicated to all things professional fighting. Each Monday, we recap the major events from the weekend, plus we analyze the week's biggest news. We also bring you exclusive interviews with the best fighters, coaches, and experts in the Hispanic and Latin American scene. You can find Hablemos MMA every Monday morning on your favorite podcasting platform. Suscríbete y nos hablamos pronto. Chao.
I often say, man, you know what? If I was as badass as these MMA fighters who go out there and perform in front of millions on television, thousands in attendance pre-pandemic, if I did interviews, I'd be wearing these robes a la Ric Flair in a jacuzzi with bitches and stuff. But it's those guys that are quiet and reserved and calm. Those are the real gangsters. Look at Corey Sandhagen just chilling out there, just waiting for his turn to be summoned up. Upon because he already knows he's a gangster. What's up, Corey? How you doing?
Hey, I'm good, man. How are you?
Good. I've always liked your style, man. You always promote your team, your hometown, the kids that you do work with, and then sure, yeah, let's get around to the fighting, you know. Yeah, it just so happens I'm a bad. But no, seriously. It's been fun watching you progress through LFA, and in less than 3 years, you're already at the top of the heap of the bantamweight division. You just took out Marlon Moraes. Congrats.
Yeah, thanks, man. I mean, it's been a really quick journey. But yeah, I mean, it's been fun, man. I'm really grateful, and I feel really blessed to be where I am right now.
Yeah, and you know, one of the themes as of late has been, how do you bounce back from a loss, and what does that say about you? You know, Colby Covington, he fought Kamaru Usman pretty tough. He won a couple rounds, and then he lost in the end in round five. But then he comes back, and he had a really, really nice win. Statement win. Same thing. You know, you had the setback versus Aljo, and you came back against another tough opponent. Boom, statement win. Did that win feel almost better than all the other ones combined in a way? I mean, because you had to dig deep career-wise.
Yeah, it felt good, man. I knew that it was a big one. I knew it was either one where I was going to win and look good in, or I was going to, you know, I was going to probably just get thrown aside for a while, you know, and I definitely didn't want to get thrown aside. I wanted to still be in this title talk, and that's what I'm doing here. I'm trying to win a championship, and yeah, man, it was tough. I had to be really honest with myself as to why I lost that first one, and I had to do a lot of work on me, and I did put in all of that work, and it showed up when I fought Moraes. And fights are crazy, and you, as much control as you think you have of them, sometimes you don't have as much control as you think. And Definitely, you know, grateful that I was able to win, because there is a level of you not really being in control when you're in a fight. So I'm just grateful, man, that I was able to do so well.
Was that soul searching all you, or did you have to lean upon either family, teammates, or coaches to really, really just give you an honest assessment of that fight?
It was pretty introspective. It was pretty myself, you know. Like I would say that one of the things was just not being in a good headspace before I went and fought Sterling, which, you know, I kind of don't even really like bringing up, because it sounds like I'm making an excuse, but I wasn't a good enough fighter at that moment to know enough about myself and to know that I needed to be different that night. And it was a lot of kind of looking into that and being like, well, how do I fix that issue? And then when I figured out how to fix that issue, it was, you know, I just practiced that over and over and over again. Getting in an intense headspace, learning and talking to a lot of the other guys on the team was helpful. You know, like, I mean, if we're going to talk being in an intense headspace, I think Gaethje is a really good example, and his fight is in a couple days. And just listening to that guy talk, I was like, oh, that's where some people go in their heads, where they want to, like, you know, that they talk about seeing this person's blood and they want to, you know, they want to create car crashes and all of that. And I had never really seen the game like that. And just kind of like listening to him and some of the other guys on the team, it was helpful to kind of get me to understand that, like, what we're doing is not really a game. It's not really a sport. We're going out there and we're really trying to cause, like, very serious injuries to each other. And that was a nice little reminder. You know, getting choked out was a nice reminder of, like, hey, man, like, we're not just out here, you know, making cool martial arts. Like, you know, like, we're actually out here fighting each other. And it was important for me to remember that.
Yeah, that Gaethje, man, when he talks, we all pay attention, because he does. Yeah. So deep. I think you guys are more like NASCAR car crashes than just regular car crashes. I wouldn't even like to be in a fender bender, much less a car crash of any kind. But yeah, your guys' car crashes, I think we take it for granted. We watch you guys and the leg kick and then this and then that. But we all forget about those times where you're just kind of walking, you know, like in high school, and someone just socks you in the shoulder, or you're playing tackle football on Thanksgiving, you know, and you're like, oh, my hip, my this, my that. You guys literally, you know, hammer each other for 15 minutes. I can't imagine just how tough and conditioned your bodies and your minds are to peel yourself off the canvas and then come back and be at the next practice on Monday.
Yeah, it's no joke, man. It's tough. You got to kind of be a little bit of a weirdo to enjoy it, but it's my life's work. You know, it's my passion, and I love it.
Were you a weirdo in high school, or were you one of the cool cats?
No, I mean, I tried to be as cool as I could. You know, I played basketball in high school, actually. I don't know. I tried really hard to be cool back in the day.
You got some Professor X moves, or what was your position?
what was his name, Professor X? I think it was the Professor.
The Professor. Oh, okay.
Yeah, you're talking about the white dude on N1.
Yeah.
No, he was actually one of my favorite basketball players, though. But yeah, that's what I tried to play like. You know, I was pretty decent at basketball too. I wasn't terrible. I could play.
You have a nickname, White Chocolate? What were you?
I forget what they called me. No, White Chocolate definitely came up a couple times, but I don't think that was like the standard one. But yeah, I definitely got called White Chocolate.
You remember Jason Williams? He was White Chocolate, but that was like 2 years ago.
Yeah, he was a while ago.
Yeah, he was fun to watch. All right, cool. Did you play any other sports, by the way, or just basketball?
I played soccer when I was a kid, and then basketball. I wanted to wrestle, actually, in high school, but my mom wouldn't let me because she didn't like the idea of me wrestling around with guys in a singlet. So so wrestling was off the table. But nah, man, just basketball. And then I actually started doing everything when I was in high school, too. As far as, like, MMA, I signed up at Nate Marquardt's gym, so I was kickboxing and doing jiu-jitsu and a little bit of wrestling when I was in high school still.
So you're 29. You've already had the 10-year reunion. Did you go to the 10-year reunion, by the way?
I'm 28, so our 10-year reunion was supposed to be this year, but it got canceled because of all the corona stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I'm just wondering when you go back, I guess, to the 15 or the delayed 10, you think people will go, yeah, I knew you were headed for this type of a career, or will they be like shocked that you didn't turn out to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer?
I think that they'd probably be shocked. I don't plan on going, only because I think that the sport is so new, and you either get it or you don't. Because actually, man, I'll get messages from people that I used to know in high school asking if I need sparring partners for my next fight. And I'm like, are you really that ignorant of like what is happening? Like, are you really that stupid where you think that like you can help out in my sparring sessions just because we knew each other in high school and you used to get in fights in high school? So no, definitely not going to be attending that. So I don't have to have that conversation a million times.
Well, all right. I humbly ask to reconsider. I didn't go to my 5, 10, 15, 20, or 25. I went to my 30th, and I actually had a decent time. You always think, because I was a weirdo, and I always think like, well, what's it going to be like? And sure, it was still a little clicky and a little this, a little that. But actually, some people took a little interest in my career as being part of MMA media. I can only imagine. I think for the most part, once you sift through those three or four numbnuts that you know say they want to train, you'll actually see a lot of people that are probably proud of you for representing the school and all that.
Yeah, sure. You might. Yeah, you're definitely right about that too. Actually, man, like, I mean, I'm from Colorado. I still live in Colorado. So a lot of my like really close friends that I had my entire life, I'm still really close friends with now. So, but yeah, I mean, it might be nice to catch up with some people from the past.
You didn't
as long
think
as they're not trying to fight me.
You didn't think it was weird that George had a 5-year reunion? Like, how much you guys miss each other? That in 5 yeah. years, you want to know, oh, what did you do? What did you do?
That is a little weird.
Man. All right. Corey, I still want to talk a little bit about your performance. Man, were we blown away when we were watching this fight, because you were always one step ahead and you just had this calm look to you. It was a different demeanor. What was it? What can you attribute it to? Was it something that you saw on tape? But you just seemed so comfortable the whole night. What can you attribute that performance to?
It was like what I was talking about, man. Like I practiced a lot on fine tuning where my head needs to be before I fight, and I did that every single sparring session for this entire camp, and I'm gonna do it in every single sparring session in the future because, you know, your mind is in control of everything. So I'm really good at convincing my mind that you know, it's before a fight that it's almost invincible. You know, like and that's where I was before that fight. I remember just a couple thoughts trickling into my head right before that fight, and I remember getting a little bit nervous and getting a little bit scared, and I remember having complete control of telling that fear, like, hey, man, you have no home here tonight. Like, you have no home. You're not going to help me here. So I was fearless that night, you know, but it was just a lot of me just practicing being in that mode, you know, like being in that mode of like, this isn't winning or losing tonight. Like, this is living or dying. And I think that if I can, you know, like put myself there, I think that the body will really respond well to that, and it will put itself in a position where it's in complete survival mode, and the body is a really, you know, it's like a really ancient, it's a really ancient thing, you know, it's a really ancient organism. It's like millions of years of evolution of keeping itself alive. So if I can convince it that, hey, we're going out here and we're either living or dying, I think that its response to that will make me perform at an incredibly high level and have an incredibly high level of confidence. And I think that that's probably what did it for me in that Moraes fight.
After a win like that, you have your corner men, you're getting interviewed, there's all kinds of things that happen. But the first moment when everybody goes away and it's just you, what were your thoughts about how the night went? And did you feel any different than any other night?
Yeah, that honestly, it takes a little bit after a win and a loss to kind of like feel like I'm back to being myself. So that usually, honestly, it takes about a week. It takes about a week for me to be like, okay, now I'm kind of settled in, you know. But I do remember when I do kind of come back to myself, there's just like a lot of gratefulness, man, because fighting is a crazy sport, and no matter how good you are, you can always lose, and it sucks to lose, and it's just like a lot of gratefulness for just being, it feels like allowed to win on that night. You know, I don't really know how else to describe it other than that.
Well, you don't do it too often, and you know, when you look over at your record and the way you've been able to bounce back after a loss, it's very impressive. The last loss, though, Aljamain Sterling, I think in a division like yours, we feel like all you guys are probably going to end up fighting multiple times. You're probably going to see him again, but when you see him the next time, are you hoping he has a belt around him, or are you hoping for more of a fresh matchup?
I don't care. I see a lot of guys, and I've even caught myself in a lot of trouble having too many opinions about who they want to fight next, and having too many opinions of like perfect scenarios in their own heads of what's going to happen. And I've kind of abandoned that type of thinking, you know, like the UFC is really taking care of me as far as opponents and stuff. And whoever they give me next is great. And if it's Aljamain with the belt around his waist, then great. If it's Aljamain not with the belt around his waist, that's great too. So it really does not matter to me. I'm here to fight anyone, and that's been the case since I got into the sport. And that's what I'm gonna do. I'm just gonna keep fighting whoever they put in front of me, and keep doing well, and then everything else will solve itself from there.
Will you do any version of a camp for the next couple months, keeping an eye on Jan versus Sterling on December 12th, you know, just because obviously you stand out as the number one contender to those two. And also, well, I guess answer that one first.
Yeah, definitely. That's my plan. You know, Marais landed one really good low kick on me. So I'm trying to do my best to kind of like keep it moving so that it doesn't get weak and I don't let my body get too weak. But I mean, that's the plan, man. Like right when I can get back into, not maybe the hardest training in the world, but you know, like if I could be 80% for the next month and a half until and kind of like feel out whether or not those guys are actually going to fight, especially today with like the coronavirus and all of that jazz. I mean, weird stuff is going to happen all the time. So, I mean, I'm definitely going to stay at about 80%.
Yeah. And then the part two to that question was going to be, you know, like Conor McGregor didn't want to be any form of an alternate or a standby. Michael Chandler gladly took that role for this Saturday. I guess that was going to be my next question, was if you would even, if they offered you that, would you do something like that?
Yeah, of course. They haven't said anything to me. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But either way, I understand that I'm right now the number one guy that would jump into that spot. So I'm not going to be stupid and just, you know, blow that away because I don't want to train, you know, like I'm going to definitely keep myself prepared, and I have no issue, or my ego has no issue with being an alternate for that fight.
Okay. Last question. You've told us in the past about the work that you've done with the kids. You know, that was a few years ago. Kids are growing up. Have any of them kept in contact with you or reach out to you and just tell you about the inspiration you've given them?
No, they're kind of young, man. So they're like, they're 6 to 12-ish, you know, and most of them are a lot younger. So when I bring up MMA or they find out that I'm a fighter or whatever, they think that I'm fighting John Cena and I'm part of the WWE, you know? So I don't, you know, they're a little too young to really understand what's going on. And so I don't get too much of that. Honestly, I don't really like talking about it either, just because these kids do come from a long line of trauma and really rough upbringings. And, you know, I don't want, you know, some type of unnecessary feelings towards me for what I do. And so I kind of just try to keep it on wraps.
Okay. Well, understood. But either way, much respect to your work that you've done and what you've shared with us in the past.
Thanks,
Corey. That was an outstanding performance. I'm telling you, we've covered this sport for a long time, and those fighters that take a loss, like the one that you did, a lot of them take that second or third, and all of a sudden, a career can go in another direction. That was very impressive for you to come back from that. And now, really, if you think about it, you know, I handle a lot of the rankings for USA Today Sports and MMA Junkie. We call it a round robin. You've each kind of taken each other out now, you know, so it's still kind of even. Even though Sterling's now just in the position of, I guess he really had the first of the three losses between you, Marais, and him. And so that's why he's fighting Peter Yan. But I'm telling you, you're all going to fight each other. This division is gangbusters. Dillashaw's come back. Cruz hasn't gone away. Aldo just joined the ranks. Edgar. Woo! I mean, this is an exciting division, man. I know you're going to be at the top of that division, possibly and probably maybe even wearing a strap. Because another thing, we're in Vegas, and I hear the talk. You've been the favorite in a lot of these fights, and a lot of them just say the guy does everything very, very well. So keep on doing your thing, and respect to your humbleness and all that. That's really, really refreshing.
Yeah, cool, man. Thanks a lot. Anytime you guys want me on, man, just let me know.
Thank you. Appreciate it, man. Take care. We'll see you.
Yep, you guys too.
All right. All right, there you have it, folks. Corey Sandhagen, the Sandman. Couldn't be a nicer fellow.
Yeah, he was super cool. Very, very motivating.
Yeah.
You started off today like a monster.
Yeah, you know, I was told that a few weeks ago as well, so maybe that's what I'll just have to do, a little, you know, a little caffeine before and just get into it. I went for a nice little brisk, excuse me, now I'm burping, a brisk walk before the show, so that was cool. I came in, got a little haircut, took a shower, and then boom, we were ready to go. But you know what it is a lot of times these athletes also lift the morale, I guess, of, you know, it's a lot more special to start off with one of these guys or gals. Corey's number three. It goes Yan, Sterling, and then Sandhagen. And he's the number one contender to Yan and Sterling, who are fighting on December 12th. For those of you that don't know, that's official. That fight is happening. In fact, I already know some additional info. The other fight that night is Megan Anderson is going to challenge Amanda Nunes for the featherweight title. And Amanda Nunes, she's in the main event. Sterling and Yan are in the co-main event. So I'm just going to get into it right now, Goes. Let's tackle a tough subject. I know where a lot of people know where I'm headed. But I guess it would be out of respect to Amanda Nunes and the five or six title defenses that she has, the title of GOAT, meaning the greatest of all time when it comes to women's MMA. I can agree with all that. She's also the heavier weight class because featherweight is 145. And bantamweight is 135. So really, the UFC can just say, why wouldn't we, right? However, at the same time, the UFC is tricky. The UFC just kind of does the old, you know, well, you know, they slip the puck by the goalie, you know, in many different ways. And isn't Yan Sterling really the bigger fight? I mean, much respect to Amanda Nunes, but the one criticism that's always been heaped her way is she really doesn't sell many pay-per-views. Now, the last year or so, we haven't known as much about pay-per-view buys. You know, it eventually comes out through the ESPN era. But I don't know. I guess I used to hear more pay-per-view talk when it surrounded maybe Conor McGregor and Jon Jones. And other than that, not many people bring it up. But I do know that when she did fight at times, 100,000, 150, you know, she's somebody that needs to be partnered up with another champion. But again, isn't Yan and Sterling the big ticket on this card? Like, isn't that the better fight of the two? And again, no slight at Amanda. She's so impressive that I don't think too many people are giving Megan Anderson a chance, or has she slipped into the Mike Tyson realm where nobody had a chance against Tyson? We just wanted to witness the destruction in a minute or two or 3 minutes, whatever it took.
I think it's all of the above. The easiest way for me to figure those things out are just if I'm in Vegas and there's two doors and one says Yan and Sterling and the other one says Amanda Nunes and Megan Anderson, which one am I going to walk into? My answer is pretty easy. And I think most MMA fans, their answer is probably pretty easy as well. And you're right. It's no slight against Amanda Nunes. You put the right name there. The name Cyborg's next to there. I'd probably go to that fight before I would do the other one. It's not a female versus male thing. It's just that's just the way it is. And I agree. I probably would have put the other one on top. But at the same time, I mean, she is a dominant champion.
She's heard it.
Maybe it's a little bit more of a respect thing. Who knows?
Yeah, I always wonder what's the trade-off between what's really the bigger fight, you know, like who's got the main presence on the poster, who's walking out last, all that stuff. And I can't always get a feel for the consistency or the lack of inconsistency. Sorry, what I really should say is the consistent lack of inconsistency from the UFC. So you'd think we would have kind of figured them out by now. Like, look, let's segue into another topic. Dana White said it would be ludicrous to think that McGregor versus Poirier at 170 would be the way to go to anoint a 155-pound number one contender, because we know that the winner of that fight probably gets the winner of Habib versus Justin Gaethje. Why would it be so ridiculous when he fought Cowboy at 170 and he was willing to do it then? I'm telling you, if Habib would have said, that was impressive, McGregor, you and I next. You don't think you think the UFC would have told Habib, no, we can't do that. They fought at 170. He's not a clear-cut number one contender yet. Hell no, they wouldn't have done that. So again, why go down that road? Is it still just only the hardcores will pick this off? The other millions will eat whatever I give them?
Pretty much. I mean, I think if you look at the things the way they are right now, you see more and more fighters that are just kind of individually jaded at different times. And right now, Tony Ferguson, that's one of them, right? I think little things like this start to add up to the point where now fighters are starting to be annoyed by it a little bit. And they're starting to realize that they have a little bit more power, not the ultimate power, but they have a little bit more than maybe what they realized in the past. And they're starting to get mad. And that creates problems when they're trying to book fights. So I don't think it goes unnoticed, but the UFC can kind of do whatever they want. And you're right. I mean, they do need to be called on times when they're not being consistent. But really quick, going back to Amanda Nunes and Megan Anderson, the only thing that I can think of, George, and this is conspiracy theory guy goes here, if I had to figure out why they're doing something like that, maybe what I would say is this. Look, we're trying to book a big boxing match with Amanda Nunes, and we can't do that if we're making it look like she's not even important enough to be at the top of a UFC card. It's the only thing I can think of. Is, hey, they're planning for the future, and there's the possibility of that big Clarissa Shields fight or something else, and they're saying, let's try and make this girl as big as we possibly can.
I don't think it's that one. I think maybe there's a lot of truth to what you're saying, that in the future that's going to be some sort of a big fight. But with them being on ESPN, they're a lot bigger than we know. Like, for example, he's already saying that this fight is trending to be bigger than Habib versus Conor, which sold 2.4 million pay-per-views for the company. And remember, that's the record in MMA, and it's one of the highest in combat sports. The only ones that have beaten it, I believe, are Pacquiao versus Floyd, then Conor versus Floyd, and then there might be a Canelo versus Floyd. I don't know. But it's up there. And I'm thinking, you know, what's the first thing that I thought about when I saw that goes, when he said that? I was like, where were these trends when Poirier and Tony just wanted a little bit more money and they could have been the co-main event? You know what I mean? Like, if that's a lot of money. And I know ESPN has now, they get pretty much a lot of that money because they sell the pay-per-view, you know? The UFC gets a standard figure. But I know that the UFC has, when that figure just goes even higher than 400 or 500,000 or whatever it is that they receive compensation for, when it goes higher than that, the UFC still gets a little bit of that dough. You know what I mean? And there's still some sort of a trickle, I imagine, in the deals, because the UFC is sharp on that end, that the deals that the UFC has done, we deliver a certain amount of shows, we deliver a certain amount of pay-per-views or whatever. But where was that foresight? Where were those binoculars back then? Because, again, Poirier and Ferguson, what could they have been asking for, man? A couple hundred grand more? You know, I don't know. Could they have seen that? Should that have been on the card? No disrespect to Michael Chandler. I'm not trying to take him off. But remember, that was an issue. And that ties into what you said about Tony Ferguson. The headline on Junkie, if you go on MMA Junkie right now, is Ferguson lashes out at White. He says, why do you treat me like shit? Man, that's powerful. Like, I read that, and I was like, man, I got to unpack this and read the last few stories from both sides why that kid feels that way. Because that dude spilled a lot of blood for the UFC. He's given us a lot of exciting fights. You know, it could be that he has a damn good point. Again, without knowing, without being a fly on Mike Pence's head, I mean, a fly on the wall of the UFC, you know, maybe Tony came in and said, pay me $10 million. Well, that I get. Okay, I'm on Dana's side. But I don't think so. I think those guys are just fighting to get a certain amount of pay up front, and it doesn't seem like that can't come out of a budget that's trending to be the all-time biggest pay-per-view ever.
Yeah. What I want to know, though, is this. Are most fighters, can they keep it real? In other words, if you're right, if it is an extra 50 grand, 100 grand, whatever it is, if that's added to that fighter, well, let's just say Tony Ferguson, and Tony Ferguson comes out and loses, is Tony Ferguson then going to be okay the next fight if they go, now you're making less? Because he's basically saying, pay me more because of what I've done. Well, then wouldn't it be fair to say you're no longer doing that? That's why your pay is going back down, right? Like, I think that's kind of fair.
Possibly. But I think a proper negotiation shouldn't be just relied on X's and O's, meaning wins and losses. It should be like some sort of a you remember when Thornton Mellon in Back to School was walking around and all those experts were doing his homework and some guy presented him this big old fat notebook, and I think that was his literature term paper or something like that. They should walk in with something that says, these are the analytics. This is what happens when I fight. Win or lose, which I mostly win, I'm telling you again, this is what happens. You know, this is how things are, you know, these are the numbers that are generated. This is what has happened to other fighters when they fought me, win or lose. Their popularity has gone up. These are the numbers. These are the ratings that I saw on ESPN or Fox Sports 1 back in the day. These are the reported pay-per-view buys associated. This is the growth that I've taken every single fight. You know, something that just, other than just like, hey, man, I won and I deserve more money because that's what other fighters get. It has to be something where, you know, sat down, two guys on either side, you know, glasses, ties, something presentable like that that expands on your case.
I agree 100%. It's basically what your worth is. You're showing them what your worth is, right? And you're putting it on paper. The only problem is when you get to a certain point, if it were you or I, and we say, hey, MMA Junkie, this is what we're worth. It's right here. But MMA Junkie said, nah, we're just not feeling it. We have options of doing other things, right? The question is, what does Tony Ferguson do? They tell him you can't fight no more. What has he done in his life to prepare himself for whatever's next, right? Some fighters have it. Other fighters don't. And the UFC knows that. And that's the problem. They get
well, to not a certain only that. Well, not only that, you raise a good point in the sense that you and I guess, could say, well, okay, see ya. Thanks, Junkie. Whereas right. He can't. He's tied to the contract. He can't even go to bare knuckle if they're going, hey, $2 million to fight. Come over here. You know, dangling the carrot. So, yeah, that they are shackled a little bit. But I still think a fighter can have a case, even coming off a loss. Conor versus Nate, he made Nate bigger. You know, Nate made him bigger as well. I mean, Nate contributed because those numbers just kept getting bigger between those two. So both guys deserve bigger paydays coming off losses. You know, that's why that third fight should be a mega fight. I guess you just have to do it with, like I say, sound and hard evidence, and I think they'll write the check. Poirier did something because he said paid in full. That was a tweet from him about 3 weeks ago. That's why he's getting talked about now with Conor McGregor. Tony Ferguson hasn't reached that point. You know, I don't know if he will. He's part of the same management group as Aljamain Sterling and Colby Covington, and I remember saying, you know, could it be that group? Are they a little aggressive? Are they going too high? But Covington fought. He came to some sort of an agreement recently. And Aljamain just signed. He's fighting on December 12th against Peter Yan. So I don't know. Is it something specific to Ferguson? Who knows? But they need to sort that out because that's too good of a fighter for him to be once a year. He's got to fight two or three times a year. A lot of these guys and gals, I think, could and should. I don't believe so much in the 20-year career. I believe more in the 10-career year where you can earn as much in 10 years than you can across 20. I don't need you to get your brain rattled around in practice and in fights for 20 years. That is a long time. You know, you got to make the most of it what you can. Think about NFL running backs or something like that. I think the average lifespan there is like 3.5 years. The top guys, Frank Gore, Emmitt Smith. I mean, a few of those guys have had long, long distinguished careers, but usually that doesn't happen. So,
hey, I don't know, man. If you were an upcoming fighter, because a lot of us live in the MMA bubble, right? If you're an upcoming fighter, would you want a manager that's kind of in that MMA bubble? or one of these other managers that focuses kind of like on Hollywood, NFL, but they're diving into MMA a little bit? Because I used to think, give me the MMA bubble guy all day because he knows what's going on and all that. But I'm starting to think, like, these outside the bubble groups that have come in, they have a different mentality. And it's almost like they can't be pushed around by the UFC, or they can't be told, well, if I'm going to give you this deal, maybe this other fighter on your stable is going to suffer or something. Like, I don't know. At first I was kind of nervous when some of these guys did this, but I think it's actually paying off.
Yeah. As you were talking, I was trying to compute it. I remember when CAA kind of came into the fold. They represented Cain Velasquez, I believe, for a while, TJ Dillashaw. Hey. I think Kevin Lee's with them, GSP. You know, have they done anything that's been outstanding? Well, maybe a couple. Maybe they got them into Reebok or Monster or whatever. And then I think back to the guys like Ed Soares back in the day, Ali Abdelaziz, Adi Attar, the Kawa brothers. You know, okay. Adi Attar got a Puma deal for Izzy. The Kawa brothers got Nike for John Jones. Ali Abdelaziz, on that front, I don't know he's had as much like that one windfall, but his fighters seem to get paid very, very well. So I think at the negotiation tables where he shines, I think he's able to leverage the deep roster that he has as well, and it comes around. It's not like one guy constantly gets used to get other people's money. Because have you ever seen the harmony on the dominance team on social media? And I know Ali gets accused of, well, it's you. You're controlling on the accounts. But I don't see it that way. Because I think eventually a fighter would go, bitch, stop tweeting. You know, like, I'm not that in love with another guy in the stable. They all seem pretty seem to get along. And they seem to have bought into a system. So to answer your question, goes, I think – The ones that have put their time in, the Butlers, the Kawas, all those guys, seem to maybe squeeze a little bit more using that long tenured run in MMA versus the outsiders. I'd have to be proven wrong on that. Somebody would have to go, oh, yeah, I'm from CAA. Look at this. And then I might stand corrected. But I don't remember that. I don't remember guys coming from the outside and doing anything remarkable.
I'm thinking GSP getting that middleweight shot.
He did get Under Armour. Hold on. He did get Under Armour.
Under Armour. I'm thinking.
Was he with Sherry back then or anybody else? Because that was such a long time ago. It's really testing my memory. Ed probably had a hand in Nike Brazil for Anderson. I don't know, man. I don't know. I know. TJ's with Tiki now. He's no longer with CAA. Kane's pretty much retired. I don't know. I'd have to see. But I don't think I've seen anything too golden coming out of fighters represented outside the MMA bubble. So I don't know if it's worked or not. Because, look, I don't care how sharp you are. I don't care if the real Ari from Entourage sat down across from Dana White. I think Dana White still has the ultimate, this is the deal, pal. And if not, we're fucking moving on, you know. And he has the case study to show it. We moved on without Tito. We moved on without BJ. We moved on without a 155-pound weight class. We moved on after Ronda, after Brock, after Connor. We can easily just keep throwing shows. Why? Because there's new stars that pop up. And I think he's created a business where it's pretty much successful no matter what. And really goes Ronda, Connor, Habib, Brock, Jones, all those are cherry on Sundays. You know what I mean? He's constantly serving up Sundays. I mean, and they're all delicious. You finish it and you go, man, that was awesome. I can't wait till the next one. And like I say, when those guys come around, he just sprinkles in a little bit of those extras on it and it's even more delicious. But really, that company is super profitable. They don't need any of those guys. But when they do come along and they blow up, like Masvidal has of late, bam, perfect, even better, you know? And so that's why I don't blame those guys that say, this is my number, I know what you're up to, I know what you're doing, and they stand firm. Masvidal stood firm, and then he got paid, you know? But that also comes with repercussions, because when Masvidal lost to Kamaru Usman. You could hear him on the tape on Fight Island Declassified telling Dana White, give me a 6-week camp. I'll be ready. I know I can beat that guy. Okay. And so playing hardball didn't get him the fight originally. He came in with 1 month, sorry, with 1 week to go. He showed up, he fought, but you could tell the competitive spirit. He felt like, damn, you know, like, okay, I got paid, but now I'm not champ and I know I can beat that guy. I need to get that proper 6-8 week camp and then really, really make an attempt to beat that guy. When do you do that and maybe possibly sacrifice the leverage that you have to getting paid more? Because that's where the leverage came from. Oh, what? Burns? He can't fight? Fuck, now what do we do? And then Masvidal makes the call. I'm ready. Let's do it. You're going to pay me. You know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yeah. Can I segue into something?
Yes.
Okay. You're talking about the cherries on top of the sundaes and all and how there's just constantly new crop. Have you been watching Embedded?
Yeah, I've gone through three of them.
Okay. I've gone through three as well.
Is there a fourth yet? Or no?
I don't know. I don't think so, though.
Okay.
Michael Chandler, that's a cherry right there, right?
That guy not a pay-per-view cherry, but you can do a fight night around him. He's obviously the alternate, but he's not a pay-per-view cherry yet.
But he can blow up.
Maybe. He's got something to him because now if you can say – if he can give Khabib the first L – along with being the former Bellator champion, when you can brag about having two belts and having beaten a Khabib, a Benson, an Eddie, like all-time great lightweights, sure, your stock can rise. And now it just matters about whether that registers where Charlize Theron is tweeting Dana White. Oh, my God, he's awesome. You know, that's that extra level of superstardom. I don't know if he can reach that right away.
He reminds me a little bit of a GSP, his personality and just the way how people gravitate to him a little bit.
Yeah.
And another guy that I'm very, very glad because this happens in our interviews, Jared Cannonier got a lot of FaceTime.
Yes,
and people have been able to see how charming he is and how funny and just he's just a straight up nice guy, dude. And it's because, you know, he looks so menacing in the cage and all that, but he's a really, really nice guy. And you see him interact with a lot of different fighters and the crystals, and, you know, he's got that side of him. But I'm glad that he was able to shine a little bit here, and I hope that he can blow up a little bit more. But it's just, dude, if you're at the top, you're constantly looking down. There's people looking right up at you like, I will take your spot at any second. You know, Justin Gaethje, he's another one. Like, that dude is just so much fun to watch.
Yeah, man, I'm telling you, the UFC has an incredible business. Early on, it was a struggle, $44 million in debt, $54 million with the production of The Ultimate Fighter Season 1, and then Bonner and Griffin put on that awesome fight. Spike gives them more money for Season 2. More stars are being made because of the show. You know, Diego, Kostya, Kenny, they came out of that, and boom, they're off and running. But I think one of my examples used to be in the past, it's like they're a cartel. They got all these tunnels and submarines and, you know, aircrafts. And sure, you're going to catch some of them. You know, we couldn't get that load through or this load through. But so many of them do get through, you know, and it's just a matter of time. And, yeah, Chandler could turn out to be pretty big. He's very well thought out in his way when he talks. Sometimes he shines even the most when he's just a little bit of a square and he calls somebody a nerd. Or sometimes he'll just get on Twitter. And, you know, like he called Tony Ferguson out using the capital letter on the first – letter of every word, you know, and says, hey, man, you had your chance. So he has a little bit of a pushback that gives him a little bit of a swag, but he needs to get the results. He's not coming over as a Bellator champion. Remember, Pitbull's the champion. He's coming over as a former Bellator champion, but this could erase all that if he were to beat Khabib Nurmagomedov in a couple title defenses. I think you're right, Goz. He does have some of that GSP charm.
Mm-hmm. I'm still thinking of when he called was it Will Brooks that he called a nerd? No. Wait, somebody called – yeah, I thought he called him one time a nerd on Twitter. I remember he said, did he just call me a nerd or something like that? But then he also told Pitbull, remember when he said, beat it, nerd?
Possibly. He's one of the Frady brothers, so that saves a little bit of face. But look, the UFC paid him well, and he's not coming over as champion. So there might be some analytics – on Michael Chandler. They see how popular you are, your social media. You know, when you show up to a job, you show up and say, look, I went to college, I did this, or I have this experience here, you know, whatever. And then they either give you the job or not. And I think that's the same thing with MMA. You know, you hopefully come with way more wins than losses, hopefully a win streak, hopefully you won some belts along the way, a good presence on social media. And I think the UFC goes, okay, it makes sense, let's write the checks. And if not, then not, or whatever. But he got it, you know, good for him. And I think he's been blessed, actually, in a lot of his free agency. I think Bellator paid him handsomely the two times he was a free agent, you know, and didn't come over to the UFC. And then this time he's coming over and he's getting paid well. And by the way, Goz and I did a sit down with Chandler about a week and a half ago. So there's been like two or three recaps that have come out of the interview that we did with Michael Chandler. And along the lines of those recaps, you'll see the video highlights. So that portion of the interview that accompanies the recap, oftentimes you miss out on the whole interview. And that was about a 40-minute interview, if I'm not mistaken, with Michael Chandler. We talked about everything, and he's so cool. We spent some time. Check that out over there at youtube.com/MMAJunkieVideo. Tell us what you think. You can leave comments there. There's some savages in there. Or you can just hit us up on our social media, twitter.com/MMAJunkieGeorge. That actually works for Instagram as well. And then for Goz, it's Twitter or Instagram.com/TheGoz, TheGoze. Also, if I may, Goz and I are going to be hosting a UFC 254 watch-along on Saturday here on Sportscaster. So you might as well hit that subscribe here on Sportscaster so that you get the notification anytime we're on. But in this specific case, we're going to watch the pay-per-view along with you all Saturday at 10 a.m. Pacific, not p.m., 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. We're starting off with two prelims on that fight card. You can all access that on ESPN2 and watch along with us. At 11 a.m. Pacific and 2 p.m. Eastern, it becomes a pay-per-view. You got to pay the $64.99 to get the card. However, if you don't get it, hang with us. We're paying for it. We're watching it. We're talking about it. We're describing it. We're yelling at the TV. We're cheering. We're high-fiving. We're drinking. We're eating. It's going to be a good time. Hang out with us, and we'll tell you exactly what's happening in real time. UFC 254 watch-along here on Sportscaster, 10 a.m. Pacific on Saturday. Goes the Modelo's, the Heineken's are ready. How pumped are you, man? We got a great title right there.
Yeah, we got to do some early day drinking. But all that means is just get up a little bit earlier, eat your breakfast. But don't forget, I mean, if you're one of those guys that just kind of goes off of the main card starts at this time, like, nah, you got to watch social media. Because a lot of times George and I get in here like an hour early. We just love doing it. So make sure you're with us for the whole ride because it's going to be a really fun card. It's a great card. And like, if Dana White's correct, this is going to trend to be the biggest card ever.
Yeah, you definitely don't want to miss out. And for those of you that are wondering why they're doing it early, all the other fight nights in Abu Dhabi have been prime time for us. Really late over there. I think the fight cards have been starting like at midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., and then they fight till like 8 in the morning. So all the fighters have been basically showing up 10 days earlier, going through their quarantines, fighting jet lag and programming their body to fight at that time. Over here, we're like business as usual. We haven't really been aware of the sacrifice they've made over there. This time, they're fighting in prime time over there to accommodate the audience in the Middle East and Russia, where Khabib Nurmagomedov is a monster. He's going to be watched probably on free TV in Russia. And so the UFC made that exception, and that's why it's going to be an early edition for us. 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. That's us here on Sportscaster. The pay-per-view starts 1 hour later. So we'll be hanging out with you guys, like Goz said, an hour early, watching those prelims. And yeah, Goz, Embedded has been awesome. I've loved it. Did you watch Fight Island Declassified?
I still haven't, no. Not all of it. Sorry.
Okay. John Morgan did an article on it, and he basically reviewed it along with chiming in on his time there at Fight Island is where what he observed and what matched. And, you know, it's pretty good. It's really, really detailed. It's a long read, but it's a pleasant read. I actually shot him a message yesterday, and I think people would like it. But of course, I think, you know, nothing beats watching the video as well, because you see there's a lot of great storytelling from a lot of the athletes, for Dana White, for the UFC, the people behind the scenes. There's big highs, there's low lows. It's really, really great. The only thing I wish is that Ron Perlman would have been the narrator there. Mm-hmm. But, man, that thing was great. I cannot emphasize it enough. Put that ahead of a movie on Netflix or any other plans that you have that weekend. Watch it. Seriously, watch it. Especially if you can get it in before the pay-per-view. It's an easy watch. It's four episodes, about 45 minutes long each. So you could probably binge watch it here between now and Saturday.
Cool.
Yeah. Tomorrow at this time, maybe around this time, the fighters will be weighing in. We'll have an answer. Maybe even late tonight, depending on, you know, how they're figuring it out over there. But that's pretty close. I've seen the fighters. They're being very respectful. So this is a fight card that's selling without pushing and shoving, yelling, cussing, none of that.
So let me ask you this. Those millions of people that are going to be watching it in Russia, cheering on Khabib, are they going to be happy or are they going to be disappointed?
I've been asked that a lot, and this is what I tell people. Khabib has not only not lost a fight, he rarely loses rounds. To make a bet with conviction, meaning a lot of money, to back Justin Gaethje, I think it's foolish. It's foolish to say, I'm betting $1,000 on him, all right? Let's say you make $50,000 a year, and you have some disposable income to gamble and have some fun, and so your average bet is $100. I guess the 100 should be the top that you should put on Gaethje, because if you lose and then you go, what was I thinking? The fucking guy's never lost. He rarely loses rounds. All he does is take people down, wrap his legs around them, trap a wrist, and beat the shit out of people, submit them or whatever. What was I thinking? That hurts, you know, to just toss away $100, especially with Black Friday coming up, Christmas. So maybe even do something less. Take a chance, you know, take a chance on Gaethje. I get it. I'm not against that. But don't put a ton of money on a guy who against a guy that you know, has shown us. I mean, the tangible evidence is there in his record. Now, has he fought someone like Justin Gaethje? No. Justin Gaethje has a lot of formidable attributes. A, he's got power in his hands. B, he's tough as nails. He doesn't break. C, he's got amazing leg kicks. D, he's got experience going 25 minutes because he's been a world champion before over at WSOF before it became PFL. He's lost. He's not scared of losing. He already got past that. He was actually an undefeated fighter into the 18th or 20th fight of his career. So he's had a little bit of that feeling where you just walk on water and you're indestructible. That guy, if anybody, does have the attributes to beat Khabib. So would it shock me if Khabib lost? No, it wouldn't shock me either. But I still feel like bet smartly. Don't put a lot of money on either side. Kick back and enjoy it. If you want to make a lot of money, then maybe grab Gaethje in a small parlay with a few other fighters, and maybe you can turn your 100 into 1,000 or your 25 into 500 or whatever the math is. But I gun to the head, I'd take Khabib, of course. My life depended on it, I'd take Khabib. But more than likely, I'll be betting Gaethje because of the odds. I think I've rethought Joey Odessa, noted odds maker Joey Odessa's take on the word value. He says, I hate that word. Don't use it. And I go, why? He says, you shouldn't bet on a fighter because he has value. You should bet on a fighter because you think he can win. And he has a point.
But isn't that the value?
Well, yeah, that exactly. I rethought it, and I thought, well, wait a minute. That's the first thing I think about when I'm judging. I don't just go, he can't win, but there's value. I don't say that. I always go, he can win. And there's value in the huge odds that you get. So I think I got to have a meeting of the minds with them and go, I've rethought what you've said. I just want to add an amendment to that or whatever. But I think Gaethje has the ability to win, and he has that kind of value. I think Teofimo Lopez also fell in the same boat when he was fighting Vasily Lomachenko last week in boxing. There was value there, and he had the skills to win. Now, did you firmly believe he was going to win? Well, no, you got to firmly believe in one of the two, and it's usually the favorite for a reason, but still doesn't mean that they're indestructible. Lomachenko had brought a loss into that fight. It's not like he had never lost before. Khabib hasn't, but still, yeah, I think that word can be used a little bit more, loosely, like people have been using it, and I think there's a play there with Gaethje.
I feel like if Lomachenko would have lost, you could look back at some of the rounds that he – well, I mean, he did lose, but you look back at some of the rounds that he gave away, right? That's something that you never get from Khabib. He never gives anything away. You have to earn it. So you know if Justin Gaethje wins that fight, it's because he had to climb that mountain. He had to overcome something horrible on the other side. You get a very honest fight out of Khabib. So it's very hard to take Justin Gaethje. I've always said if somebody's going to beat Khabib, it's Justin. And after that, I don't think I would probably never turn in any other name other than Khabib. But I did kind of come to reality and say, look, to pick somebody other than Khabib, you're just not paying attention to the facts. You're not looking at everything that's going on. So I turned in Khabib. But I think Justin has a very good chance. I think he's that type of fighter that could beat him.
Yeah, you need a wrestler, you know, who can hold their own and stop a takedown or two, get up from a takedown, mitigate the damage of a takedown. But you also need to be able to have hands, you know, and because Khabib has developed some striking, some formidable striking. And so you got to be able to not only match that, you got to be better than that. So when the fight remains standing, you have some sort of an advantage. Chandler has hands. He can wrestle. Gaethje has hands. He can wrestle. But you got to be able to stop some of the takedowns, not all of them. Khabib seems to get everyone down. Even GSP. GSP used to go against a lot of wrestlers. John Fitch wrestled at Purdue. Josh Koscheck wrestled at
San Jose State?
No. He wrestled in New York, like Edinburgh or some small school, but he was a national champion. You know, so he came across some wrestler. Jake Shields wrestled at San Francisco State. So my point is, GSP wrestled people that got to a higher level than him in wrestling, except his wrestling was very effective for MMA, and then he matched it with ground and pound, the ability to have good riding time and seek for some submissions, and that's why he was a beast. So we'll see, man. I think Khabib has been teasing that Dagestani wrestling is just better for MMA than American wrestling. We'll see. We'll see if even Justin Gaethje wants to do it. Justin Gaethje may only want to stop it, and that's it. He may not even want to take the takedown against Khabib. I think it would behoove him to get one takedown and get some damage and get in Khabib's head and know that, wow, I got to be leery of his takedown. But Justin's not like that. Justin's a zombie. He wants to throw hands. He wants to get in car crashes like Corey Sandhagen said earlier.
Is he going to throw that leg kick, though? It worked. It's a big weapon for him, but I just don't know if he's going to throw it against a guy that's probably hoping he does.
He should throw it to end his combos, like Boss Rudin says, to just throw it out there early. If somebody can time it and get it, and if you get taken down in the first minute and you're underneath a beat for four, your gas tank just went down, you just took some damage, you just lost 10-9, possibly 10-8. Because remember, the 10-8 round can come through the three Ds, damage, duration, and dominance. You get two of those three, and a lot of judges are writing an eight next to your name if you were on the receiving end. Mm-hmm. So what does that mean? Well, if he was on top, then that means he had the duration. If he took you down in the first minute and had you down for 4 minutes, there's the duration. But if you were able to lock him up and hold him, well, then you mitigated the damage. He won't get that. What about the dominance? You know, were you turning your back, and then he beat you up, and then you would get back, regain guard maybe, and he still stood on top and he just dominated you in every position, or maybe even went from guard to half guard pass to full mount to take your back to, you know, on top. Did he also dominate you while you were on the feet? You know, again, that's what goes into those 10-8 rounds. You got to make sure you don't want to give up one of those, and Khabib has the ability to do that if he gets the takedown early. So I think early on, you want to be in a little bit of a lower stance, and you don't want to, you know, going back to what Ghost said, do you want to just give a kick away and have him catch your kick and then all of a sudden take you down? I don't know. But at the same time, do you want to not throw kicks because of that? You got to balance it. So a lot of times, Khabib's really, really good about covering up. I think if you can throw a combo and end a combo with a kick, then maybe you can get some of that damage in on some of those, you know, on those thighs. The lower leg kick has become way more effective, it seems like, and that's obviously tougher to catch. Could you do that? Justin's had fights stopped from the thigh kicks, but the lower leg kicks, I haven't seen him have as much success with those like other fighters.
I think it's difficult to replicate somebody like Justin Gaethje in a camp, just because Justin, he's wild, but there's technique behind his wildness. You know, the punches don't come from traditional areas. Like, he's throwing them from odd, almost like Tyson. Like, Tyson could throw a power punch from just about any position, off balance, on balance. I don't know how you prepare for Justin Gaethje. I think that's the part that's probably going to mess with Khabib a little bit. It's trying to figure Justin out, but that's kind of that time that Justin Gaethje needs to implement his game. And that's where I think the winner is going to come in this fight. It's going to be the guy that gets off first and puts all their chips in.
Yeah. I mean, when you get them thinking about what you're doing, you're right, because you seem to be less focused on your offensive attributes. Unless you're a seasoned counterpuncher, then they're at an advantage for sure. I think that reflects in the judges' scorecards. That said, I do want to say counterpunchers, for a while, that strategy's tough in MMA, because if that opening isn't there and the other guy is just a little bit more active than you, but not as offensive, but you weren't able to do anything off your counter strike, you know, offense, guess what? You just given away the easiest 10-9 ever. And then the other guy only has to maybe get you down at some point, or just win the round. I've seen a lot of fighters take split decision losses. Again, my man Jorge Masvidal comes to mind. He realized it a little bit late. That guy could have been a superstar 5-10 years ago. You know, he fought for the world title at Strikeforce at 155. He lost to Gilbert Melendez. You know, he was part of Bellator as well. He wasn't able to grab a title there. And then he was in the UFC and dropped a couple split decisions that still had to hurt. Ally Quinta was one of them. Lorenz Larkin was another. You know, so these were fights that were within his reach. So what did he do? He started to become a little bit more offensive. He even had a setback in the Stephen Thompson fight. He wasn't having success in that one. But in the Darren Till fight, remember, he got knocked down, but then he was able to come back and get Darren Till down. So, yeah, at some point, you have to be the leader of the dance.
Yeah.
All right, folks, that's our episode for today. We got to get on out of here. We talked a little bit about Tony Ferguson, the Poirier-McGregor UFC saga. So we touched on a little bit of news. And then, of course, we got UFC 254 coming up on Saturday. But I really want to thank Corey Sanhagen for his time. He was on earlier on the show. And here on our channel, if you just scroll down below, you'll see all the interviews that we've done, mostly on Wednesdays. But now our permanent days of broadcasting the show is Mondays and Thursdays. So check out some of our previous episodes. If you're part of, if you like to hear the podcast form of our show as well, we're available on Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and Spotify. And by that, I mean, look, if you're catching us here, that's what we would prefer. This is our home here on Sportscaster. But we've done 3,000 other shows in the past 15 years. So you can go into a deep dive there using those popular podcast platforms. Also, last reminder, UFC 254 Watch Along is on Saturday here on Sportscaster on this channel, 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. We will jump in here and do the last two fights with you guys on the prelims, and then the pay-per-view starts at 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern, for the pay-per-view headline by Khabib Nurmagomedov versus Justin Gaethje. And how about that awesome co-main event that features Jared Cannonier and Robert Whittaker? Do not sleep on that one either. Yes, you heard it right. Morning on the Pacific time zone, early afternoon on the Eastern time zone. They are going prime time out in Abu Dhabi. So this is an early edition of what might be the biggest pay-per-view ever, according to Dana White, but it probably at least for the year 2020. Khabib's popular, folks, so don't miss out, all right? Set your alarms, do your reminders. 10 a.m. Pacific, 1 p.m. Eastern. We'll see you here on Saturday. Thank you all for your support. It means a lot, and we'll talk to you soon. Go out there and be a champion.